And on our 230 docket, we have two cases which are interrelated. We took a break to reconstitute the panel, and we are pleased to have with us this afternoon Senior Judge Peter Nay, seated to my right, and of course Judge Karen Ashby, seated to my left. Before we get started, let me ask a few questions about timing here. We've talked about this. I know the parties filed, or I think it was the appellees filed, a motion for extended oral argument time, which was granted in the first case, which is the Ross, make sure I have the right one here. We're going to go with the first case being Ross versus Warner, with Mr. Ross as the appellant. And we have the Warner defendants that I refer to as the Warner defendants, which are separate from the Allstate and State Farm defendants. I'm calling the Warner defendants the other parties included. Let's see, let's refresh my memory here. The Warner defendants I'm referring to is Box Brothers, Bueller Moving and Storage, and Adam Warner. And I believe those three defendants are represented by counsel, counsel.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And then we have State Farm and Allstate.
And my name is Jeff Whittaker, 13840 in the Hyper Allstate.
For Allstate.
And Catherine Cobb, 40063 for State Farm.
Okay.
And Mark Levy for State Farm, and this Cobb is doing the arguments.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thomas Beam of the Warner defense.
The Warner defense. All right. And then we have Mr.
Rosenberg, Michael Rosenberg, 27471 for the appellant in the first appeal, William Ross. With me is Timothy Garvey, who's with my law firm, and then Saul Sarney and Summer Luther, who were trial counsel for Mr. Ross, who's also in the courtroom.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. And then we have a second case, which is the Allstate appeal, which we will handle after this case. All right. Now, in this case, I just want to make sure we all are on the same page, because we have a cross appeal in this case. So we have 25 minutes per side, and obviously the appellant has the opportunity to reserve time for a rebuttal, and that will also apply to the appellee as the appellant in the cross appeal on this side. So you're going to have to divide your own time and reserve enough if you want to have rebuttal for the appellant, and also answer within that same reserve time to the cross appellant's opening. Over here on the appellee's side, we're going to have three different counsel arguing for three different defendants and multiple defendants collectively. And so you're going to have to, I would like you to tell the court how you're going to divide your time, but it's going to be self-monitoring. You monitor your own time. If you go over into one of the other appellees' times, that's going to be between you guys, all right?
You know, Mr. Bean is going to take 15 minutes, Ms. Cobb is going to take 7 minutes, and I've been relegated to three.
To three, okay.
And if there's any of that time left, I reserve that on my cross appeal.
Okay.
So we'll use all 25 minutes one way or the other.
Okay. And you, since you have the cross appeal, you're going to monitor that for your potential reply.
Yes, Your Honor.
To any response that
Mr. Ross has.
Yeah, so I'll pull Mr. Whitmore away from the podium and say it.
Okay. I think we're all on the same page. Any questions or any other comments before we begin?
Just one question. So yes. Will there be any color, will the color coding?
There will be, we'll put up 25 minutes.
I see that up there. Okay. Will the yellow go off with 10 minutes?
I think the clerk, or bailiff rather, Reed, can you answer that question? I'm not sure if it always, the yellow always goes off when 5 minutes is left or not.
It's my understanding we can change the warning, the yellow warning time to a different time of 5 minutes if we'd like us to.
Okay, would you like that? Would you like it a little more than that?
I would, if you could just to make sure I have the full 10, if it's not too much trouble. If it is, it's not a big deal. I can figure it out.
It's done.
And yes, Your Honor, I'd love to have the yellow go on at after my 15 minutes with 10 minutes left.
So the yellow light will go on at 10 minutes for both sides?
Which would be the equivalent of the red light for me, basically.
Okay. Does that work?
That's great.
All right.
One more question. Water, people bring it to the podium.
Sure. Do you want to?
It's angled, so I didn't know.
Well, that's a flat spot. If there's a spot, it seems like we've had that occur before.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's fine with me if you want to, and if there's a place that you can set it there.
Let's just see if it works.
See if it works. Ooh.
It's precarious.
Is there a flat spot up at the top toward the light there that might work?
If you don't mind, just sometimes I get parched.
That's fine.
Just reach
that's fine. Just reach back there and get it. That's fine with me or with us. Okay. I'll remind those in the gallery, please turn off any cell phones or pagers so that, and all of us, to do that so that we don't have any such things going off during argument. It's going to be difficult enough to keep all this together, right? So we're ready to proceed on this first case, which is 2012 CA 2094 Ross versus Allstate. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Michael Rosenberg for the appellant William Ross in the appeal involving the Warner defendants and Allstate and State Farm. Much of what I have to say here in oral argument, we didn't request the extra time, the defense did, and so I probably will reserve quite a bit of my time to hear what additional things they have to say. And really, I just want to focus on a few things, sort of expound on things that were set forth in the brief and kind of summarize for you where I see this case now as it's presently postured. I don't believe there's any question that Mr. Ross did not get a fair trial. His trial was inexorably tainted with this workers' compensation evidence, and that's where I'm focused, because the defense has really put a lot of stock into this need for Mr. Ross to prove an assignment in order to recover any damages to which Pinnacle would have subrogation interest. And it's a pretty critical issue, and there's a case called Harms versus Williamson that we cited in our reply answer briefs that addresses this specific issue. That case was not, even though it's on all fours, it was not brought to the attention of Judge Crabtree by the defense when they moved and argued that evidence of workers' compensation was relevant in the case because of Mr. Ross's purported need to prove up an assignment. And, you know, ordinarily, you would have to prove an assignment. That is the law of assignment. Workers' compensation is a completely different scheme. And the assignment that they talk about, and Judge Briggs in that Harms versus Williams case that I mentioned, because it wasn't cited in their response to our opening brief either. But the case, Judge Briggs goes through a detailed analysis and pretty much hits on all the things that we mentioned in our opening brief in terms of why it is that you can't open this workers' compensation door at all. You see what happened. This we should not have a different collateral source rule or a different standard for the admission of evidence depending on whether somebody's injured on the job by a third-party tortfeasor or off the job by a third-party tortfeasor. And in your typical case, a plaintiff may have health insurance, and that health insurance company has paid, say, $50,000 in medical bills for the plaintiff. The plaintiff goes into the case against the third-party tortfeasor and introduces not just the amount that was paid there, actually, under the trio of cases we talked about. The Supreme Court has gone even further and said that a plaintiff can recover for the amounts billed even if they weren't paid, and that evidence still doesn't come into trial. This is also codified in statute. The Supreme Court has said the statute was applicable at the time of this second trial, and the statute was not brought to Judge Crabtree's attention by the defense either. And that statute, as the court knows, as a per se bar on the admission of collateral source evidence in both UM and third-party tort cases. It couldn't be more explicit. This was a UM and third-party tort case. Part of what's made the case confusing is that these UM insurance companies require, under their insurance policies, that if you want to bind them to a judgment against their uninsured motorist, they're supposed to be providing essentially excess coverage to Mr. Ross for this uninsured motorist. You have to sue both the uninsured motorist and you have to sue the insurance companies. So Mr. Ross, and then we also, Mr. Ross had to sue because there was an open question as to who owned the tractor trailer, or who was responsible for it at the time, Box Brothers or the other entity. And so getting back to what I was saying, this case of Harms versus Williamson, which hasn't been addressed, my guess is had been brought to Judge Crabtree's decision. We're not here having this argument. He probably wouldn't have let any of this evidence in, because it all came in under this the guise of a voluntary or gratuitous payment and or our need to prove an assignment.
Let me interrupt you there, counsel. It's my understanding, and I know that Appalee will make their own arguments, but it's my understanding that one of their arguments is that you invited the error, or Mr. Ross invited the error that was made by Judge Crabtree by relying on an assignment and arguing in pretrial pleadings that an assignment existed. I didn't see an actual assignment in any of the record, and I think there was a document that indicated that you introduced that indicated Pinnacle gave you authority to protect its subrogation rights or something like that. It gave you authority, but it didn't say anything about assigning a right to you. How do you respond to defendants' claims in that regard, and why did you come in with this particular document that you did introduce?
Sure. I'm glad you got to that, because that's as important. This ties in with the Harms versus Williamson case, because they were making the exact same arguments that are being made here, and they were summarily rejected. But in terms of invited error, and I noted in State Farm and Allstate's answer brief, page 13, they say Ross inserted the issue of Pinnacle's alleged assignment into this case by arguing in pretrial pleadings that an alleged assignment exists. That's not what happened. They filed their joint motion for determination of law. Before the second trial, and in their joint motion, they say that Ross should be precluded as a matter of law from recovering work comp benefits
or in the alternative, Ross should be made to produce the assignment, and defendant should be permitted to introduce work comp evidence to the extent needed to raise factual defenses. That's how it was injected into the case. Prior to this, prior to the first trial, Mr. Ross had filed a motion in limine saying no evidence of workers' compensation benefits has any place in this trial. And that's what the quote that we cited in our opening brief from Judge Blackburn said, it borders on frivolous for somebody to try to argue in light of the statute, the trilogy, the fact that the statute merely codified the common laws that existed before, and it unquestionably applied at the time of this trial. To say that we somehow invited this error turns the whole doctrine on its head. I don't see how one can ask or compel you, force you to introduce something, and then claim that by responding to what they were saying, either your case is going to get thrown out or bring something to court. That you somehow invited the error. And so here's what happens. 8 months before, 9 months before, actually, the trial, in response to that joint motion for determination of law, the one that ultimately got Judge Crabtree off track, in response to that joint motion, the letter was attached, and I have a copy. It's very short. I can read it in, but it was attached, I believe, either to the response or to the reply that was filed in connection with the joint motion. And while when I sit down, I'll try to find the record sites so that you have the. But so what happens is the court, in response to that joint motion, they produced this letter. Would the court like me to let you look at it, or? I think I may have left it.
Was it included as a part of the record? I think we have it already. I'm recalling seeing.
Yeah, it's in there. It's Exhibit A to, it's either the response, I can't tell because the stamp is illegible, the e-filing stamp at the top, but no, it's definitely part of the record. It's dated July 13, 2010, but it wasn't provided until about 9 months before the first trial, as I said, after this issue came up on the joint motion for determination of law. And it's written from Pinnacle's counsel, subrogation counsel, Ty Quinn. And she says, this letter will serve to confirm our telephone conversation July 9, 2010 regarding Pinnacle Assurance's subrogation lien interest in the above matter. As we discussed, Pinnacle has an assigned statutory right of subrogation pursuant to CRS Section 8-4-203. Pinnacle has authorized your office to pursue / protect Pinnacle's lien interest in the third party claim.
I recall that from the record. I didn't recall it was in a letter form.
So this is produced, and the defendants don't say anything. The judge's order, actually, on the motion, Judge Crabtree, this is on his order on a joint motion. He says, as an assignee of Pinnacle's subrogation rights, this is where he sets forth the questions and then proceeds to answer the questions in the memo type of format. He says, as an assignee of Pinnacle's subrogation rights, what must Ross establish in order to recover the workers' compensation benefits as damages? So he's calling Ross after that letter was produced an assignee. Now, the Harms case says that, and Larson and Amger and the cases that Judge Briggs cited, a lot of states have these same statutory workers' compensation schemes, and they are all interpreted across the board, not in a technical manner for the benefit of third-party tortfeasors and their UM insurers, but to provide for the allocation of proceeds so that Pinnacle can recover benefits that it pays in an appropriate case. That's the scheme, and it's the scheme around the country, and they do not treat the assignment language technically. It is a subrogation interest only, just like a healthcare insurance company has a subrogation interest. So what should have happened in this case is Mr. Ross should have been allowed to present his evidence of here are our medical expenses for this claim, the jury comes back with whatever award it comes back with. And then, post-trial, if they can't work it out, Pinnacle and Mr. Ross, you can petition the court, under the authority in Jorgensen, you know, to try to sort it out and divide it. Judge Crabtree tried to, and it's pretty clear when you read the record, he was trying to, sort of short-circuit, if you will, that he said he didn't want to be in a position of having to sort out, you know, Ross's damages from Pinnacle's damages, and that was his justification for putting a non-party on a verdict. And then, of course, afterwards he recognizes he can't enter a judgment for a non-party, and so he changes it around to say he's going to give it to Mr. Ross, but as an assignee of Pinnacle, with, you know, no authority for any of this that I've seen or that's been cited in any of the briefs. So what's going on here is that they sit silent for 9 months with this letter, okay? And then at the close of the plaintiff's case, and then again at the close of the defense case, they raise this technical argument and say, oh, there's been no evidence of assignment. Case over. Everybody goes home, there's nothing to award. And when Mr. Ross and his counsel kind of hit the roof because they had wisely, unwisely, whatever, assumed that everything was good, if they produced the letter and didn't hear anything back from Pinnacle, that you know, they had the ability to go forward and pursue their damages, and that's what the law allows them to do. And so they raised that this wasn't brought up in the trial management order. There was no real party and interest argument that was made. There were no arguments at all that put us on notice that you were going to come in and try to argue this assignment. And Judge Crabtree finds that based on the facts and circumstances, the letter, the fact Pinnacle hadn't intervened for, you know, all these years, even though they had a right to do so, And you know, frankly, this is the way these cases are typically handled. While Pinnacle does have a right to intervene, most of the time it deems it a wiser decision to let the plaintiff pursue the case and to assert its subrogation interest at the end of the case, just as the health insurance company does. And, you know, Mr. Ross couldn't go and abscond with those funds. They're going to have to be either agreed upon some allocation, or you're going to have to go back for a hearing of some sort in front of the judge, you know, under the authority of Jorgensen. So what you have then is where they then go with the defense is, well, assignment, that's a standing issue, it's subject matter jurisdiction, we can raise it on appeal. I mean, that's sort of the absurdity of their position, is that they believe that they can come in at this time on the appeal, and they're asking to get out scot-free from having to pay anything due to lack of assignment, not citing you to controlling authority, Arms versus Williams, as it says this is not so. And that's where we find ourselves. The other thing I wanted to touch on, and I see I'm already at my yellow light, so I won't say too much more, but, you know, this isn't a situation where we can look at what happened here and try to remand it and say, oh, let's just move the numbers over into Mr. Ross's column, and, you know, because Pinnacle, you know, if he's not treating in the future, all that future money is just sitting there. I don't know where it goes. I don't know what happens if Mr. Ross were to die. Would it go to his heirs? Because this is all stuff that's never been done before. And that's, you know, where we find ourselves. This cannot be the way these cases should be tried. And as I said, it's not the way they're typically tried. You come in, you bring in evidence of your or medical expenses, benefits, and then you sort things out after the fact. And that's how Pinnacle wants it too. That's why they wrote the letter. The only difference when Pinnacle intervenes is that they don't have to pay any attorney's fees on the portion of their recovery. If they choose the subrogation route, then they are responsible because the legislature recognized that, you know, you can't just have your hand out, you know, not recognize that there were attorneys involved that were needed and have to be paid in order to make, you know, happen what happened. But what I wanted to say is that these closing arguments, when you go back and read these closing arguments, you know, this is how you know that the trial wasn't fair. You know, and I'm just going to highlight a few of them, as opposed to reading through them all, but this is from Werner's closing. Somebody asked me whether or not he would be made whole since this was tax-free. Okay, great question, great question. And the answer is yes. Mr. Sarney then gets up and says, oh gosh darn, they didn't include this amount, this one paycheck, and so therefore the amounts are somehow different, and he should have gotten a little bit more. But the process was they were playing the system. They wanted the 66 2/3 for the wage loss. You go on down to the medical benefits. They covered every single medical benefit there was. You also heard that they were paying for any future medical benefits. Then we sit here and hear Ms. Luper say, oh, I want future medical. I want all this additional wage loss. He was paid the wage loss, okay, while he was on through work comp. Now, they also say, we'll pay us for physical impairment. My suggestion is zero. Why? Because take a look at these other things. Medical benefits, total, okay, permanent partial disability right here, the extent of any medical impairment. Also, residual impairment is under permanent partial. Residual impairment, medical impairment, who has already been paid for his impairment? Team Ross. Team Ross and Team Lawyer have already been paid for it. Did they agree to do it? Of course they did. But now all of a sudden it's kind of like, no, we want more, okay? What it boils down to is they're trying to make a big claim for wage loss. To continue on.
Yes, you have 6 minutes left, Mr. Rosenberg.
The other thing I'd say, in addition to kind of going on and on about the fact he's already been compensated, calling him a double dipper, a system manipulator, a system worker, you know, these things tainted this trial. And the only thing that you can do is remand for a hearing on damages. I think the liability determinations, frankly, I think it's remarkable that they returned a verdict at all, given what the arguments that you see in the close. Even to the wrong party, but the fact they were even able to do that, given the evidence that they came in that should have never come in. So I think with that. Oh, one other thing. You know, they all made settlement offers to Mr. Ross. $200,000 for the Werner defendants, and $1 at one point. First it was $100, then it went to $200. My only point in this, they were all making these statutory settlement offers along the way. At no point in time when they were doing this were they asking Mr. Ross to prove that he had an assignment. But yet that settlement, had they reached it, Mr. Ross would have been having to deal with Pinnacle. So it doesn't make any logical sense to me that you somehow treat the issue differently depending on whether it's a trial versus a settlement. That they need to prove an assignment for trial, but they don't need to prove an assignment or require one for settlement. It's highly inconsistent, their positions on those issues. So with that, I will reserve my remaining 4 minutes.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Thomas Beam, registration number 1763. I was the trial counsel for Werner, Bueller, Moving, and Boxburgers. What I wanted to do was start with a couple of issues that won't take a lot of time, and then I want to focus on that collateral source issue. The prejudgment issue is fairly simple. In the beginning, the plaintiff in this case had a choice. He had two roads that he could go down, one or the other. One road was to not take workers' compensation benefits, which is his option, or the other road is to take the workers' compensation benefits. He's basically at the fork in the road. He can go either direction. What's he decide to do? He chooses to go the workers' compensation road. Each of those roads has certain advantages and certain disadvantages. One of the disadvantages for going the workers' comp road is you don't get prejudgment interest under the statute. There is no allowance for prejudgment interest. Is this out of the ordinary? Is this unusual? Is this shocking? Absolutely not. Most of my time, Your Honors, is spent on railroad cases, FELA cases. Under the Federal Employees Liability Act, it's essentially identical. There is no prejudgment interest under the FELA, much like there is no prejudgment interest under this workers' compensation statute. Now, occasionally an employee will be faced with having to make that choice too. He gets to that point in the road. It may be a crossing accident where someone is pulled in front of the train and the employee is injured. If he opts to sue that driver for negligence, then he can go after the prejudgment interest under the basic tort law. If he chooses to go after...
Is that what the plaintiff did here?
Yes.
He sued exactly. The driver for negligence, right?
He sued the driver for negligence, but he also went after the workers' compensation. Once he did the workers' compensation, he no longer owns that claim. That claim is assigned.
If he had an assignment, right?
No, the statute has the assignment. The statute, our particular statute, says that claim is automatically assigned. Once he goes down that road, that assignment goes over to Pinnacle. What you have are two different claims, one economic claim, one non-economic claim. The non-economic claim is never assigned. He retains that exclusively. The economic claim is assigned under the workers' compensation statute to Pinnacle. So what you then have is a situation where he has given up half of his claim. He retains the non-economic portion of the claim, the pain and suffering, and the economic goes over to the statute. That is in the brief. If you pull up the statute, it is abundantly clear. Bottom line is, this particular statute, the workers' comp, makes no provision for prejudgment interest. If he wants to change that statute, he needs to go back to the legislature. He doesn't come here to the court to change the statute. That takes us to the cost issue. That goes back to who owns the claim. That's what I was talking about. If he goes down the road of the workers' compensation, that claim goes over to Pinnacle. They own it. Ross owns the non-economic claim. Ross did not prevail on the non-economic claim. Therefore, he is not entitled to any costs. Right?
Who prevailed on the non-economic claim?
No one prevailed on the non-economic claim. The only prevailing party was essentially the economic claim that Pinnacle paid. And the jury awarded the Pinnacle money essentially because they acted in good faith, and that was the instruction that Judge Crabtree gave. We argued, number one, Pinnacle had never assigned that claim, so therefore he had no rights to make that claim. All right? And then, in addition, we have argued that Pinnacle paid voluntarily. Why? Because what happened was, one of the reasons he didn't get any money is because of their multiple acts of dishonesty and surveillance tape. But what was going on was he was playing games. All right? So one of the games that he was playing was on this assignment issue. He wanted to claim an assignment early on, then he didn't want to do the assignment during the course of trial. He never put on one iota, a scintilla of evidence of the assignment. So the question is, why? Why not? He had the Pinnacle people on stand.
Was he required to?
Yes, he was required to. If you're going to...
What about Tate?
I'm sorry.
Tate?
Oh.
The case, well, Tate, does that make any difference in the requirement for the filing of an assignment or not? Or use of an assignment?
It seems to me, Your Honor, that if you're in the middle of a trial and you've got someone that's claiming that they own the vehicle and it turns out they don't own the vehicle and there is no assignment, you're always going to have standing to say, hey, you have no claim here. You don't own the economic claim. The only way that claim goes back to Ross is by virtue of an assignment. Okay? It has already gone by statute to Pinnacle. The only Pinnacle has the right under the statute to come in and sue my clients. Okay, Pinnacle can do it independently. Pinnacle can do it in conjunction with Mr. Ross.
If Mr. Ross had not sued the tortfeasor, then Pinnacle could have sued the tortfeasor.
And Pinnacle does sue.
Yes.
Pinnacle sues independently. That's under the statute. They can do it independently. They can do it together with Mr. Ross. Okay? That was that Martinez case that was cited in the brief. Martinez filed suit, which is what should have happened here, for his non-economic claim. Pinnacle then filed suit for the economic claim. Then the jury is told who has what claim, and they determine what entitlements Pinnacle has, what entitlements Ross has, or in that case, Martinez. So the bottom line is, if the claim is not signed, then there's no way that he can get costs on a claim that he never owned in the beginning. Now, why didn't they put on this evidence of the assignment? Like I said, they had the adjuster and the legal counsel for Pinnacle sitting there. Okay, you remember this fork in the road. He had a choice to go down two different roads. All right, what they were trying to do was get the best of both worlds. They were trying to get the advantages of not asking for work comp benefits and then get the advantages of asking for work comp benefits. So they play fast and loose. Go ahead.
Are you saying that without the assignment, Pinnacle could not go post-judgment after Ross for what they had paid without an assignment?
Oh, yes, he could. Pinnacle could go back after them, and that was in
it. I mean, that's in the statutes,
yes,
right?
Yes, and Your Honor, that came up during the Kerfman testimony. That's what Judge Crabtree was asking about. And what's going on is they're playing both sides of this coin. At the pretrial stage, they indicated that Pinnacle was involved in this case and that they had an assignment. Ultimately, they never proved up any assignment.
Did you call that letter an assignment?
No, I wouldn't. I don't know that it qualifies for an assignment. It was simply a confirmation of a phone call. Normally, the assignment will be in a legal document of sorts. I hereby assign to you this particular claim. Now, if you go back.
Well, let me, just to clarify my idea about workers' comp and how that enters into this type of situation. Can an individual, without an assignment, without a letter, just after they've accepted workers' comp, proceed on a normal tort claim, except after the case is all over, the workers' comp carrier can go after that judgment to the extent that they paid workers' comp. I mean, without any letters, assignments, doesn't the statute provide that the workers' comp carrier can, after judgment, retrieve their money? They can enter, if they wish to, they can enter into part of the injured party's case and have attorneys of their own.
Let me see if I can help you with this. These are the options under the workers' comp. Number one, he doesn't have to take the benefits. He can file the lawsuit. You can apply your collateral source rule. The issue about workers' comp never comes up. He didn't collect any of those benefits. It doesn't come into the case at all. Number two, Pinnacle could sue individually, independently, under the statute for those benefits. Number three, Mr. Ross can sue independently for his non-economic claim that he has never assigned.
Well, that's why I get confused, because I thought my understanding of the workers' comp statute was that the injured party, the plaintiff,
yes, Your Honor,
can bring an action for all the damages, including what he got for workers' comp, However, the workers' comp carrier can then go and retrieve what they had paid.
My understanding.
Is that possible?
My understanding, and Mr. Whitworth does a lot more workers' comp than I do, my understanding is that once those claims have been separated, once the non-economic or the economic claim goes over to the work comp carrier, the only way for that plaintiff, that for Mr. Ross, to go after that money is if he takes an assignment from Pinnacle. Pinnacle owns that claim, so Pinnacle has to assign it back. If they assign it back, then yes, he can go back through that. Okay, he can file for both of those claims.
Okay, your position is there has to be an assignment,
yes,
by the workers' comp.
There has to be, because your case law shows that that claim is owned by Pinnacle. There is no, it is assigned by statute to Pinnacle. Therefore, Pinnacle is the only one that can prosecute that claim, and they can prosecute it by doing an assignment if they so choose.
Which case law, what case law are you relying upon now?
The statute.
You,
the
well, you statute said case itself. Law, you said your case law provides this.
I have to get it. I'm sorry.
What, do you remember the names?
No.
What case law are you relying on? Is it Tate?
No.
Is it Gomez?
No.
Is it?
No.
Sunahara?
I've got it back there. I've got it back there.
Okay.
Let me talk for a second about collateral source, because that came up. Okay. One option is, like I said, not to take the workers' comp. Okay, and then he can keep both of those claims. Okay, and if he doesn't get a full amount of recovery, if he doesn't at least achieve the minimum amount for workers' comp, then he can go back after the workers' comp folks and get that deficiency. Number two, he can take the workers' comp and he can pursue that claim on his own for the non-economic. That was that Martinez case. Okay, and then he could let Pinnacle intervene. That was option number two. Another one is to take the workers' comp. Okay, and then you prove up the medical bills with the providers like you do in a regular case. Okay, you don't do it through a Pinnacle adjuster. That's what they did. Okay, you don't try to backdoor the medical through a Pinnacle adjuster. You don't list the Pinnacle person as a witness on your case if you want to keep your collateral source in play.
May I interrupt you?
Yes.
Hadn't the trial court already decided at that point that that evidence was coming in, that there was, so why would the court, having made that determination, why would you try and try your case as if the court had ruled different? I guess what I'm saying is the court had made its ruling with respect to the collateral source rule. So wouldn't counsel then respond on the basis of what the court had ruled and present their case accordingly?
You would. What you would do is present your case without using those Pinnacle people. He didn't need to use
the Pinnacle. Why would you not use the Pinnacle people in light of the court's ruling?
Because then you're going to invite error, and you wouldn't have to. You could treat it like any other case, and you wouldn't have to put those people on.
But it wasn't any other case at this point. It was this case in the context of the court's ruling on the collateral source rule.
That's correct, and the workers' comp came in because it was considered voluntary. It turned out that Pinnacle never investigated the claim. When the claim came in, within 2 days, they approved the claim. It was clear that Mr. Ross was not an employee, but was an independent contractor, and Pinnacle shouldn't have paid in the first place, was what it boiled down to. And that became abundantly clear. So we certainly took the position that Pinnacle had no right to do it. Say, for example, you've got an auto case and you've got an automobile and the adjuster pays, yeah, the adjuster pays $20,000 on a $10,000 claim. What happens is they bring in the adjuster to prove up that, hey, this is what I paid. I paid $20,000, therefore I'm entitled to that back. I'm legally obligated to pay it. Okay, they wouldn't do that. They bring in the body shop who would say, yeah, the value is 10, I should have paid 20. In this particular case, They brought in somebody to say these were the bills, these were necessary, we were legally obligated to pay this.
Excuse me, I think somebody else is at the vote.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Hobb, attorney registration number 40063. With me is Mark Levy, and we represent State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. Continuing on with what Mr. Bean was talking about, it's really the facts of these cases that's made all of these things come together. There was a, as part of the work comp statute, work comp insurer determines compensability. There was an issue here that they didn't do an adequate investigation that came up during our discovery process. And so as a defense to the subrogation claim was a voluntary payment defense. It was on that voluntary payment defense that Judge Crabtree decided that there should be evidence of the workers' compensation investigation and the reasonableness of their claim.
When you say voluntary payment, are you referring to a gratuitous payment?
They're different, Your Honor, a little bit.
That's what I want to know.
In the Gomez case and the City of Englewood case, they refer to gratuitous government benefits. Essentially, those are the idea that just Medicaid or anything, I think welfare is the case in one of them, those are a gratuitous government benefit and not a collateral source. A voluntary payment is different in that that comes up in the Ware case, Ware versus Federal Insurance, and it's the idea that the insurance company, prior to paying the claim, does not do an adequate investigation. So in the Ware case, they paid more than they needed to based on the policy, and as a defense, Whirlpool says, we shouldn't have to pay you back because you didn't owe that. And so that's the difference between a voluntary payment and a gratuitous payment. So the defense that was coming in was not to Ross the individual, it was to Ross who was standing in the shoes of Pinnacle at the time of our trial. As far as talking about that, Ross never, I think there was arguments that Ross was never the assignee or they never made that claim, it's really clear in the record actually. Ms. Luther stated, in this case, Ross did not obtain an assignment from Pinnacle to pursue those claims. There was no intention of Pinnacle or any conduct of Pinnacle showing anything other than allowing Mr. Ross to pursue these claims. That's at the record 7913, line 22 through 7914, line 14. At the time, Ms. Luther and Judge Crabtree were having a conversation where Ms. Luther didn't think they had to prove an assignment. And Judge Crabtree came back and said, well, if you don't approve assignment, do you have standing? And that was when we got into our standing argument. It was not first raised in the appeal or in post-trial motions. It had always been an issue throughout the trial, actually, if they had standing ever to bring a claim standing in Pinnacle's shoes. So essentially, it's the defendant's position that the invited error came when Mr. Ross decided to assume or to take the assignment of the claim and to pursue Pinnacle's claim as well as the claims that are above and beyond Pinnacle's claims, like his additional wage economic claim and his non-economic claim.
Well, Mr. Bean just said that he didn't think that that letter that was mentioned by Mr. Rosenberg was an assignment. Now, are you saying it was?
Mr. Bean and State Farm respectfully disagree. We do. State Farm accepts the court's order and determination that there was an assignment of the claim.
I thought part of State Farm's response was that the plaintiff failed to produce any evidence of an assignment.
State
Farm. And that's why your JNOV and motion for directed verdict should have been granted.
State Farm did not file a JNOV or a motion for directed verdict. State Farm agreed.
Is that Allstate?
That was just the Warner defendants. Allstate, the UM carriers agreed with the final verdict and the final judgment and did not file anything saying that there wasn't an assignment, Your Honor. Based on the court's findings that there was an assignment, we believe that the verdict form was correct, Your Honor, because if the verdict form was not manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. The parties discussed the verdict form at length, and finally the decision came up by Judge Crabtree where he said, I did not want to be in a position of having to try to divide what the jury had done. So I did set forth the basis of which the jury could outline what had been paid by Pinnacle and then what damages Ross had basically standing alone. That's what the record at 7907, lines 8 through 17. Also, I'd like to address Ross's argument that a Jorgensen hearing would have been appropriate in this case. A Jorgensen hearing is to apportion damages that have come after most, in the case of the settlement agreement, I've heard an argument that it can happen though after a verdict. The issue here is that because of the voluntary payment by Pinnacle that the tortfeasor was arguing should not have been paid, the Jorgensen hearing would not have been appropriate because A post-trial hearing would not have been able to address the question of fact regarding whether or not Pinnacle voluntarily paid benefits, and this question was a question that was properly submitted to the jury. Further, Ross argues that future damages should not have been on the verdict form. However, pursuant to Section 841.2031C, this allows for subrogation of all compensation. Paid anticipated life and future benefits. Mr. Whitworth's going to address stories and more. Finally, we believe because Ross agreed that there was no subrogation for workers' compensation against UO carriers, that the UO carriers decided those prevailing priorities was appropriate termination, and State Farm would request that the court affirm the trial court's rulings and judgment.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm sorry, that the court affirm the ruling.
The trial court's ruling and the judgment.
Thank you.
Jeff Whitworth for Allstate. I've got my 3 or 4 minutes. I'm going to be quick. The reason this case is such a terrible disaster and a mess is all of plaintiffs doing. And Justice Askew, you had indicated.
Judge, I haven't been elevated, so.
Excuse me. You said that based on the court's ruling that the plaintiff was in a position where they had to call the work comp carrier.
No, not that they had to. It's just that in deciding what their strategy would be, they may devise a strategy based upon what the court had ruled.
Then that's their fault. Invited error. That's their fault. I've never seen anyone 30 years and 100 jury trials do what they did. But here's what the court's order says.
Had you had a case where the court had entered a similar ruling under these circumstances?
No, I haven't.
Okay, then okay. I guess the prior cases okay. aren't You're all right. that relevant.
No, my point is I've never seen anybody have this situation. I've seen lots of people try to exclude comp benefits, but here's what the court ordered. It says evidence regarding any impairment rating will not be admitted. It says, however, the court is persuaded that evidence of misrepresentation regarding plaintiffs in Ross's employment status, that's all it says, will be admissible to impeach plaintiff. It doesn't say anything about allowing workers' compensation to come in. You know who called Ms. Kirkman, the Pinnacle rep? He did. You know who asked her how much benefits were paid? They did. You know who asked what benefits were paid versus what the actual cost of the benefits were? So we have the paid versus incurred benefits. Plaintiff did. They introduced all of this. They didn't have to do that in this case. This order doesn't say carte blanche, workers' compensation comes in. It says it can come in.
Well, didn't the court say that the collateral source rule is inapplicable here? That is irrelevant and inapplicable. So it seems like the plaintiff would be trying their case under the decisions that the court has already been made, or already has been made.
What I'm reading for specifically is the ruling about whether workers' compensation evidence comes in. Okay, now there could have been very limited workers' compensation evidence that comes in, like, didn't you mislead the jury by filling out this? Okay, but instead, they went that route. They went over their, they went over the TTD, the PPD, the bills versus pay issue. They invited, I'm sorry, I don't have much time. My second issue here is, they talk about Jorgensen. Jorgensen simply doesn't apply here in this case. You have a situation, I'm sure you're familiar with the Jorgensen line of cases and also the Satterfield line of cases. This is a situation when someone settles, okay? Then you've got a trial.
Counsel, you're going to have to move over behind the podium because these are being broadcast on the internet and being recorded.
I'm a moving lawyer.
Okay.
In both the Jorgensen and the Satterfield cases, this is a situation where you have a trial judge who frequently, quite frankly, knows nothing about work comp because they have not ever been an administrative law judge. And they're going to go back there and they're going to look at a settlement. And what happened in Jorgensen is they tried to dishonestly come back there and say, these are all, non-economic injuries here. So you don't get anything. And then the insurance carrier called foul, and then the judge in Jorgensen is required to go back there and try to interpret what benefits should be applied. In this particular case, okay, they didn't like Mr. Ross. Mr. Ross was incredible. I can go on a long litany of reasons why he wasn't incredible.
Your time is up, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Rosenberg, you have 4 minutes, a little over 4 minutes left.
I think I lost 2 seconds.
Well, we'll just put that on account.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, proceed.
I was absolutely startled that the Harms versus Williamson case was not mentioned by any of these defendants again after what I just said in this case. I'm going to read to you from it because apparently they haven't read it. Everything they just told you is not the law of the state of Colorado. Since 1998, when and really before that, the Tate, all Harms is doing is recognizing that Tate meant what it said, said what it meant. And so in the Harms case, the plaintiff filed for received workers' comp benefits from her employer's insurer, and she also filed this personal injury action against the bus driver, okay, who was a state employee. The issue in the case was whether or not, because it was CCIA back then, that was the precursor to Pinnacle, but CCIA, Colorado Compensation Insurance Authority, is a government entity. And so the plaintiff had given notice of a claim to the government entity, but Pinnacle had not. And same issue, there was defendants asserted in the trial court lacked subject matter jurisdiction over that part of the plaintiff's cause of action because it had been assigned by statute to CCIA, and the insurer had not separately complied with the notice requirements. Although not a party in the civil action, CAIA responded by filing a notice of statutory right of subrogation against any recovery by plaintiff. Okay, so something similar to the letter that, that we judge. Basically, Pinnacle communicating its intent that it's maintaining a subrogation interest in any amount recovered in the plaintiff's lawsuit. In the pleading, CCIA argued the statute created not just a statutory right to an assignment of the plaintiff's claim, but also a statutory right of subrogation. And that's critical. Because they, you have to read that statute literally, which case after case after case that it shows you has said that you're not to read it literally, including what I'm about to get to here. The trial court denied defendant's motion to dismiss and reasoned that CCIA was not obligated to prosecute the statutory assignment, but could instead rely on its right of subrogation. Just like Judge Crabtree. Further, the statute was merely intended to prevent a double recovery, not to prevent a full recovery. That's another point. One of the things we heard is we're in here trying to double dip. I'm still hearing it in this argument. That is not the case. Mr. Ross is not entitled to recover anything that, that Pinnacle is entitled, you know, has paid as a benefit. Getting back to that, this idea, it's a misnomer to say that Mr. Ross was seeking workers' compensation benefits pursuant to an assignment. He never was. All Mr. Ross was ever trying to do was the same thing that injured plaintiffs do when injured off the job, which is recover his reasonable medical expenses. And Your Honor asked a good question about not needing a letter for the assignment. That's what the Harms case says. And they in citing Larson, which is the defendant authority on workers' comp, it says, in no event does the assignment amount to more than a right of subrogation to the extent of the amount paid by the employer and insurance carrier. I mean, this has been a law across the country for a long time. They didn't cite it to the trial court. They're still not talking about it now. And for the life of me, I don't understand it because that's not the way I was trained in law school.
I know you only have 30 seconds left. Can you respond to, I believe it was Ms. Cobb's comment that the gratuitous and voluntary circumstance is different and how that should impact?
I think they're relying on an old line of authorities. We do address this in our reply and reply answer brief, so I don't want to give them my time to go too much into it. I'm out of time. We do have more time, I guess, in the next appeal. These issues are still.
I think
kind
you
of
had
related.
An additional 2 seconds.
finish your thought. Judge Ashby,
I'm sorry.
We asked the question.
Right, could you re ask the question? I'm sorry.
I was asking you to respond to Ms. Cobb's comment about the gratuitous and voluntary and the difference between the two and how it might impact our decision.
Right, and workers' compensation benefits, it's very clear that there is that line of authority I was talking about, things like. Perhaps certain benefits like welfare, okay, that have been treated differently because it's not something, for instance, like Social Security or workers' comp, where as an incident of your employment, you're paying consideration to have that coverage. And that's a critical, you know, distinction. That's what makes it a collateral source. That's what makes Judge Blackburn say any arguments to contrary order on frivolous. There's no question that this court is considered that it's collateral source. Thank you very much. We would ask for, as I mentioned, I think this case needs to be remanded for a retrial on damages only with the 75-25 allocation left in place. The judgments in favor of Allstate and State Farm for costs on the UM side should be reversed as well.
And, I think your time's up, Mr. Rosenberg. Thank you.